Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network broadcast and New Books in Eastern European Studies. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, and today my guest is Victoria Schmidt, who is the author with Nadia Yavorsky of a new book called Historicizing Roma in Central Europe, Between Critical Whiteness and Epistemic Injustice, published by Routledge in 2021. Thanks so much, Vika, for joining me today on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting and thank you for giving all this preparation work for me and Nadia. Thank you.
So unfortunately, due to COVID, Nadia can't be with us today as the co-author of the book, but we'll be talking with Dr. Schmidt, and I wanted to introduce both of them formally and their bios. So first, Victoria Schmidt brings together the issue of historical roots of segregation with the legacy of colonial and socialist policies in Central Eastern European countries. Dr. Schmidt started her academic career in Russia, and this period formed part of her broader interest to the historical roots of ongoing institutional violence against diverse disfranchised groups. In 2008, Dr. Schmidt transferred to Masaryk University in Brno, Czech Republic, and began to elaborate on the issue of institutional violence against the Roma and people with disabilities in the Czech land. And this led her to develop the approaches in the book towards race science and racial thinking as agents and structures of nation building. Since 2019, Dr. Schmidt leads the project Race Science, Undiscovered Power of Building the Nations at the University of Graz. And our co-author, who is here today, but silently, Nadia Yavorsky, is an associate professor of sociology at Masaryk University in Brno in the Czech Republic and a faculty fellow at Yale University's Center for Cultural Sociology. Dr. Yavorsky is a cultural sociologist in the tradition of the STRONG program, focusing on the meaning-making process in her research and on international migration. She received her BA from Wellesley College and her MA, MPhil, and PhD from Yale. And a recent book by Dr. Yavorsky, together with Carlo Tognato and Jeffrey C. Alexander as editors, published by Palgrave 2020, is called The Courage for Civil Repair: Narrating the Righteous in International Migration. And finally, as a sociologist, Dr. Yavorsky is focusing on cultural sociological analysis and the reconstruction of public issues such as perceptions of migration and the sociology of conspiracy theories. So I want to talk about the book here at hand at New Books Network, and that is Historicizing Roma in Central Europe. So my first question is the usual question: what motivated you, Victoria, to write the book?
I suppose, first of all, it was our experience. I mean, my experience and Nadia's experience living in the Czech Republic as foreigners. And yeah, when you arrive first time, so It's very difficult to understand why Roma remain to be so oppressed, why they continue to be seen as a biggest minority in the Czech Republic. And despite all these talks and despite a lot of efforts from the side of many groups, Roma remain to face a lot of problems in solving ordinary issues, so, such as housing, education for their children, or getting citizenship. So, and it's really, it's a kind of puzzle for the people who were not born in the Czech Republic, I suppose. And yeah, and many times I've heard when I started to work on this problem, and when we share with Nadia our experience, she had very familiar experience. So we were asked by Czech colleagues, how do we understand the reasons, the grounds of this long degree of segregation against Roma? So I suppose it was kind of challenge.
Yeah.
And we would like to accept this challenge, and we would like to introduce new lenses for useful and probably potentially acceptable for our colleagues, for us, for our Roma students, because both of us teach Roma students, and yeah, mm-hmm. we have very good experience with Roma students.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was one of the reasons, and naturally the second reason was very formal reason, because it was a quite good topic for developing our competences and developing our careers, I suppose, despite all these challenges. And probably precisely I was starting to think about this book 2015, when I was informed that I got fellowship for developing project regarding people with disabilities in Roma in the Czech Republic. And the very same day, I watched a documentary, and it was a very interesting film titled Suppressed Letters. And
yes.
This film, yeah, probably you know.
It's a great film.
It's a great film. And the story about the teacher who was very well accepted and until now continue to be accepted very well in the Czech Republic. And also, in order to help his Roma students to be assimilated, he was hiding the letters which were written by their parents and which were written by the children to their parents. So it was Miroslav Dedic. And also, naturally, not only this form of violence or oppression, but other forms of violence and oppressions accompanied his methods aimed at helping Roma children be assimilated. Mm-hmm. So this film was a kind of red line for the Czech society. And after first time, many people were divided in the Czech Republic into two groups. A majority of people accepted this film as a kind of insulting event mm-hmm. against the hero of education, against the prestige of Czech education, and against the history of all these efforts made mm-hmm. by the Czech educators in favor of the Roma children. But the other part, and many of those who were in this minority, sociologists and thinkers who would like to understand this ambiguity of the Roma situation in the Czech Republic, they try to stress the necessity to indicate boundaries between historical reasons for such practices as Dedic introduced and current situation. So it was really great film, and also it was great film because all these events were presented through the eyes of a young girl. So the mm-hmm. granddaughter of this Roma grandparents who experienced it, exposed this quite complicated situation, she presented this case. So yeah, it was very unusual, yeah. I suppose, event. And yeah, and I Yeah, please.
I have a lot of questions for you. And I mean, given your work in disability studies, I wonder if we could come back to that.
Okay.
But I wanted to ask actually about the intersection in the book with whiteness and critical whiteness studies, and in particular, since we're talking about the Czech Republic, how you begin to talk about this issue of assimilation and whiteness studies. So how is it that you're understanding whiteness or critical whiteness studies in the book as an issue, both as a methodology and let's say as a form of justice or injustice?
Yeah, because from the very beginning, the question was, should we focus on whiteness or racism? And why whiteness become a kind of more interesting methodological framework for us than racism, directly working with overt racism or obscure racism. And the choice in favor of whiteness was because of double status of whiteness, I suppose, for us who are not Roma. And majority of the researchers who work with the issue of Roma, they are not Roma. And naturally, whiteness, I suppose, is a kind of premises. So we need to work with our own whiteness. And I'm afraid that it's impossible to eliminate our whiteness because, first of all, whiteness operates as a kind of signifier for racial hierarchies. And whiteness indicates the double status for everybody in this racial hierarchies, because for some groups and for somebody, we are whiter, but for other groups, we are not so white. So it's this ambiguity in our own status. And it's, I think that it's a very good point. It's a very good internal challenge for our professional or research reflection. But also there is a second side of whiteness. It's our culture, our identity, our belonging to this Western culture, white culture, how we apply our Western methodologies for destructing whiteness, white methodologies for working with whiteness. So that it was very tricky, but I suppose it was one of the main things and main reasons to choose whiteness, not racism. Mm-hmm. And at the very beginning, you know that the book is divided into two parts. The first part aims to present the role of attempts to reject whiteness, to eliminate whiteness, to exclude whiteness from discursive practices in two different levels. In the level of our routine, so TV programs, so cultural events, and the second level is academic level, how whiteness and how the idea or how the hope to eliminate whiteness, to exclude whiteness, operates in the level of academic discourses and research agenda. So it was, and at the very beginning, the idea was to focus only on this section. So the book should be quite short.
And and it's eight chapters, right, with the two parts.
And now it's two parts, chapters, and the second part is much bigger than the first.
But
I suppose in terms of justice, in terms of historical justice and our own responsibility, if we started criticizing the approaches of others, we need to provide our own approach and open our own approach for debates and discussions. So it was the idea.
I'm really intrigued, Vika, and I have to say this as a historian, how you introduce positionality throughout the book. And historians are notoriously bad at this. Anthropologists and sociologists a little bit better, maybe. But I guess I have to ask this question because you have sources, and many of your sources are in German and Czech, or German and Czech and Slovak. How did you go about gathering your materials for the book? And let me just add a kind of footnote question to that. How academic are these materials when we're talking about epistemic qualities or epistemic quandaries and problems of injustice? So first is a question about your, you know, Quellenkritik, what are the sources? And then how academic are they in dealing with whiteness and Roma history?
As for the second part, I suppose it was quite easy for us to indicate the main strategies to collect materials because we were interested in answering to the question why so many parts of this history regarding the participation of scholars in establishing whiteness remain to be unknown. Because really, if you read contemporary or very recent books related to the segregation or anti-Semitism and other issues very typical of this region, you could find a lot of references related to the very positive feedback about eugenicists and anthropologists who work in this region. And I was interested why my colleagues, for instance, do not pay attention for obvious impact of the scholars on segregation, on legitimizing the various practices. So the very first idea was to go to the archives of the former institutes of anthropology, and there were a lot of such institutes, for instance, in Ljubljana, in Brno, in Prague. And first of all, we worked with the collection, with the personal collection presented in these archives. Also, I should say that many of these collections remain to be unsorted, but we have never faced any problems with getting the access. So the people who work in these institutes, who are those who we accept as a successor, so for the scholars, they are extremely open. They are interested in our discovery. So it was not only working at the archives. So also it was a kind of exchange with the successors of the scholars. It was very informal discussions, very fruitful for developing the arguments for our book. And also in two archives in Prague and Ljubljana, we worked directly in basements. So because part of the collections, I suppose it's possible to develop a kind of documentary film about how to work at the archives. So it was the first. And naturally, it was possible for us to develop and apply such method as a sociological or social biography, because the second part of the book, the reader could find very interesting, I suppose, interesting not only for us, but for the readers too, biographies of the scholars, German scholars, Czech scholars. So we would like to explain how did the scholars become those who legitimized violence, structural violence against Roma. For instance, František Štampach or Robert Ritter, Eva Justino, Helena Mala. So it was the main idea.
Could you talk about them a little bit? I don't think our listeners will be familiar with a lot of the scholars. And when we're talking, I mean, maybe they will, maybe they won't. But when we're talking about the interwar period, which is definitely, you know, your expertise, who were some of these scholars in eugenicist discourses? And I'm really interested in this for the Czech case, obviously, but maybe you could introduce a few of the names and scholars.
Yeah, as for the interwar period, it's very important to indicate the role, the specific role of the Czech scholars in developing the racialized view on Roma. And probably, the title of the book is a Central Europe, but a major part of the information stems from the Czech sources. But I suppose because of the very special role of the Czech scholars who started developing their own view, racialized view on Roma, during the interwar period, and naturally the very famous name is František Štampach. He was not a professional anthropologist, he was an educator. And it's very interesting that it's very compatible with Robert Ritter, the German very famous anthropologist who also was not a professional anthropologist, but was a child psychiatrist. So both of them were involved in the practices with children, I could say, in conflict with law, in contemporary politically correct words. But also they were very interested in their academic career. And I suppose the choice of the gypsy issue was one of the decisive for them to advance their position in this academic hierarchy. So, and it's very visible in their biographies, how did they work with this issue in order to advance their position. So, for instance, also we work with the personal archives of very famous scholars like Inge Matejka, who was the supervisor of František Štampach, and in his personal correspondence, we indicated a lot of letters from František Štampach with this push that we need to develop the gypsy issue because it should be very important in a couple of years. And it's interesting because Štampach started developing this argument before the law about vagabonds in 1927 was issued. So, yeah, it was a kind of, okay, academic readiness of non-academic and this feeling that it would be the topic very possible, very successful for developing his career. But it was interwar period. As for the period after 1945, I suppose it would be a little bit different story. And directly, the second part of the book develops the argument regarding the role of the anthropologist and eugenicist in terms of the layering and conversion. How did they develop previous practices in order to, and this after-war period, it was a period of very intensive development of inter-country networking. And first of all, it was the cooperation between Yugoslavian and Czech scholars. And after that, when they established this informal cooperation because of their informal friendship, because of their common resistance against Lysenkoism, and naturally Yugoslavian colleagues were much luckier than Czech colleagues in terms of keeping the access to genetics and other Western trends, which were a kind of forbidden fruit for the Czech scholars for 5-10 years. And it was a little bit different story because very soon, this inter-country networking were embedded into global agenda regarding the assimilation. Yeah, so it was the next step, it was the next stage of conversion, the argument developed by the scholars in Central Europe in favor of advancing global agenda aimed at providing arguments in favor of assimilation, adaptation, and so on.
Could you talk a little bit about these sort of liberal racial assimilation projects? And I'm especially interested in racially minded scholars, as you put it, from peripheral Europe. So there are these international or maybe even transnational organizations in the interwar period. And then, you know, there seems to be this intrusion, and correct me if I'm wrong, of Soviet almost pseudoscience and pseudoscientific dogmatism. But I guess what binds them together is this assimilationism or racial assimilationism. And I guess I wonder if you could explain that, if that's, as you put it, an epistemic issue or an epistemic continuity from the interwar to the post-war period.
I suppose the main thing which we need to indicate for understanding this continuity is the shift from very positive attitude to racial intermixture, typical of the scholars in this peripheral region of the world, to very global idea regarding to negative consequences of self-isolation among different race groups. So, we could say that the scholars of Central Europe were lucky because they started very soon before many others to develop this argument in favor of seeing on self-isolation as a very negative praxis. The main difference between the German view on Roma and German the explanation of Roma inferiority provided by the German scholars because of racial intermixture of Roma. And for the scholars from Central Europe, it was vice versa. It was a lack of racial intermixture. Until now, when I started sharing my very positive experience of working with Roma students, the first question which I heard from the side of my Czech colleagues is, but probably he's not 100% Roma. Probably he's mixed. He's from mixed family. So it's a very common, very well disseminated idea that the lack of intermixture is the main problem for the Roma. And yeah, until now, this idea in genetics, in physical anthropology plays very important role. And I suppose, so historically, it was this specific configuration of factors which made Central European anthropologists not peripheral, but main experts in Roma questions. So I could say that between the 60s and 80s, Czech and Yugoslavian anthropologists were these kind of world leaders in understanding the gypsy question. So they even the habit of being invited for different international events to present their view on Roma, their comparative research among Roma children and Roma families. And even after 1989, they continued to wait such invitation. And when they were invited, first of all, they affirmed this topic is a very representative topic for the progress of the physical anthropology or genetics in this region. So, yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Yeah, and so how do you see the Nazi legacy? This is a really big question. But, I mean, when we're talking about essentialism and othering and alterity, indifference, and there are a lot of words that you can use, but what then happens, let's say, after 1945? So when we're in, the world of post-genocidal memory and the reinstitutionalization of race science and anthropology, what sort of effects do the years of the Third Reich and racial hygiene and Aryanization have on the establishments and these people, as you're talking about, who are building their careers in the post-war years?
I suppose those who work in this field very well informed that German scholars who were involved in legitimizing the academic argument in favor of extermination of Roma, they did not have any consequences. So they continued their career without any problems. So they... Even more, some of German scholars were in close cooperation with international organizations, and even more in the archives of anthropological institutes, we found some letters which were written by German scholars to their Czech colleagues. So I suppose it was a kind of process to replacing the idea that the scholars were responsible for something, that this argument played any significant role. It was a one line of, understanding the legacy of forgetting or the legacy of replacing these historical events. And the second line, naturally, was keeping idea that Roma continue to be inferior because they're still not assimilated. So in our book, between the, I suppose it's chapter 6 and chapter 7, it's very possible to find this connection, how the idea of inferiority was transformed in favor of new construction, in favor of new frameworks. So, yeah, and that was the second one. And the third one was a very specific influence of Soviet experience, because during the first decade of socialism, naturally, the Soviet politics regarding Roma was accepted in many of the countries in Yugoslavia, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia. And it was, in the Soviet Union, it was constructed in direct comparison with politics regarding African Americans in the United States.
That was my next question. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. But really, Soviet propaganda promoted the idea that Roma, our African-Americans, or Negros, so we could say, but it's not politically correct, they have deserved better future, and we are able to provide better conditions for them in order to their assimilation. And it was the opposite wave from the anti-Soviet propaganda. And I discussed this issue, the struggle of propaganda, Soviet and anti-Soviet propaganda, in the previous book. It was a chapter, this book about the disability politics in socialist Czechoslovakia.
2019, Amsterdam University Press. Quick plug.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, thank you. So, yeah, so I suppose that if you would like to focus on the legacy of Nazism and racial hygiene and racialized view developed by German anthropologists, it's a very complicated question, despite many think that it's enough just to reject it, to eliminate it, to label this praxis and anti-human. But no, it's not enough, because many of the traces, many of the echoes we could hear now without any problems. For instance, very fresh example is the dissemination of the idea by Rushton, this Canadian scholar, with his idea about different strategies typical of white and not white populations in terms of the reproduction. So then quantity was opposed to quality, and one of strategies, air strategy, was seen as a strategy aimed at improving quantity and advancing the population in this way, and car strategy is a strategy for more advanced, more progressive groups. And this idea, which was applied by Rushton to African-Americans, was adopted by many scholars in Hungary and Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia, and not by scholars, but very popular also in Czechoslovakia, on Czech Republic and Slovakia. And it was a kind of a network, really. We could observe that they reference each other, they continue exchanging the results.
Yeah, I'm really curious about that, Vika. And I have to ask you, because when we're into the period of the 1960s and the 1970s, into the world of new research frameworks and agendas, and Central European scholars are becoming experts on the so-called gypsy issue, and I put quotes around that. I wonder if you could give us an idea of how then the new sort of civil rights issues involving African Americans, but also human rights issues in the 1970s, you know, the Helsinki 1975, Charter 77, and so forth. How do the scholars who are recognized in Central Europe and Southeastern Europe as experts, people like Jaroslav Suchy or Helena Mala, what do they do with the history of Roma peoples? Are they essentializing? Are they moving it toward public health and demography? I mean, what happens to this old sort of racial science and maybe even racial history, Rassengeschichte? What are these experts doing in the 60s and 70s as experts on the so-called gypsy issue?
Well, it's quite a provocative question, because I suppose that it's a big temptation to say that they did not pay attention, but I suppose they were in touch, for instance, with Milena Hrubšmanova naturally. There are letters. It was an exchange of letters between Helena Mala and Hrubšmanova, who was one of the pioneers in reconstructing Roma language, Roma culture, introducing new practices targeted with respecting Roma as an ethnic group in Czechoslovakia. But I suppose, naturally, it was not a kind of ignoring this issue, but also the scholars developed their argument in favor of segregating Roma, because from the very beginning, I mean, in the end of the 60s, the main idea of Suchy and Mahler was that only very short period children from Roma families should be placed in the institutions, and after that it would be possible for
That's
them
right.
to back. But right. in the 70s, the argument changed. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it was also pressure of this new global agenda which started developed in the second half of the 60s. And this global agenda aimed to provide new eugenic measures against those inferior groups. And naturally, anthropologists were in very vulnerable position. They continued to struggle for their place in academia, and probably they were not so strong as some of the geneticists who were able to resist this
and oppression. Do you think the focus on children and youth is part of a larger focus on education, or as you call it, ineducability, this stigmatization and maybe even dehistoricizing of Roma? I mean, how do you make that connection, especially for this period that we're talking about, 60s, 70s and beyond?
Yes, thank you for this question, because I suppose this focus of the youth was stemmed from the general global idea of developing or obtaining a new position for this former inferior groups. And educability was one of the main questions. And the second source of information for us were the archives, which house materials collected by centers for retraining teachers and retraining social workers. And it was very interesting, because in Czechoslovakia, there were two different centers. One in the southern part, one in the northern part. And both of the centers were led by two very famous educators, Dedic and Stepan. And both of these educators traced this global agenda. They were in direct communication with Suchy and Muller, and they were in direct communication with Yugoslavian colleagues. And it's possible to find the materials of global congresses or conferences. And it's very visible that they translated these ideas to usual teachers, usual social workers. So it was a very it was a way of adapting these global trends in favor of own national politics. So I suppose it was kind of history of adaptation.
Right. Yeah, and I guess could you talk a little about the Eurocentrism of that? I mean, it's not even white, you know. It's not just racism. I think you're actually correct in pointing to a sort of European or Eurocentric or white Eurocentric epistemology. I mean, is that reflected in the sources and also, I would say, in the cultural sources that you're gathering? Because, you know, you begin talking about some of these films like in the 80s and beyond. So how do you see that issue?
I suppose as for the responses, for the possibility to indicate any alternatives to this power of whiteness, what we recognized, it was some reports from the side of teachers who worked with Roma, and we recognized in the archive in Trebon. And in these reports, it was very horrible that these teachers are not sure that Roma children need to be whitened. So, yeah, the main idea was that it's against their identity, that it's a very difficult task for the teachers to put together the identity of typical of our European values and the identity of provided by Roma families. And very good example is that what is more important, child being or child becoming? It was in one of the reports that why we are so focused on the progress of our children, we are not so focused on their happy childhood. Roma children have happier childhood than many of the Czech children, because their parents love them. Love without any conditions. So it's interesting, because I suppose that those who were in direct communication with Roma social workers, educators, they faced this conflict, internal conflict. And also I could say that they were very limited in the opportunities to discuss it, to reflect it, to find alternative ways. So it's another part of story, I suppose. We could not say it was a kind of traumatization, but I suppose it was a big frustration for many of the educators, for many generations of educators in Central Europe.
And do you see any role for international organizations? I mean, UN If we're talking about demography, population in the 80s and 90s, I guess I'm interested in my question in the intersection between this sort of revised nationalism or renewed nation statism of the 80s. Do you see international organizations getting involved with so-called gypsy issue as a rights issue? Are they, you know, delving deep into the agency of Romani populations, intellectuals, issues of these larger issues of educability? Is there a role for the international community, or are you mainly focusing on the national sort of context for these scholars?
I suppose during the interwar period, the gypsy issue stopped to be the issue of national agenda at all. So even in the late 20s, it was the issue of international organization who were responsible for safety and security. But naturally, after 1945, it was the issue of educability. It was the issue of civilians over unreliable groups and mm-hmm. their natality strategies and their reproduction strategies. And yeah, we could say that the idea of this developmental idealism, yeah, that there is a very typical family with one or two children able to provide good education and other social goods for their children. And we should advance mm-hmm. this ideal for each of the country, despite of cultural differences and so on. It was very international concern in 70s. So, yeah, and naturally it mm-hmm. was the opportunity for the scholars in Central Europe to be embedded in this global agenda and to feel them more secured. It was right. one of the ways, to save their career.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's sort of my question, you know, because there are humanitarians who are anti-racist, but they're also reproducing a lot of these white supremacist discourses. And I think your book actually is interesting, you know, in that sense, because when you're talking about the scholarship, and that's my next question for you in the beyond the 80s, what do you see reflected in what people are writing about? Both as a history of the Romani people in the 20th century, are they actually allowing Roma voices? I mean, or are they just talking about the discourse that international experts and academics have produced about racism and anti-racism? How do you read that going through the historiography and the scholarship?
If we observe very strong continuity in reproducing racialized view on Roma, with adding new and new arguments in favor of this racialized view on Roma as self-isolated group, on the other side, we could observe a lot of ruptures, historical ruptures, in the attempts to provide these Romani voices. So, yeah, it was started in the 50s, all these attempts to collect Roma text mm-hmm. and advance Roma language and present Roma as those who are able to develop their own culture. So mm-hmm. it was started in the 50s, and in the 60s it was a part of the compromise between Roma elites and socialist authorities when Roma people started to develop their agenda as a part of this national agenda in the 60s. Yeah, so because we could see that the Czech Spring, mm-hmm. the Prague Spring was a kind of new movement for this national reborn. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. my view on this period. And naturally, for the Roma people, it was a unique opportunity to advance their own agenda as a part of the new national movement. And Celia Donard presented in her book precisely this view. Yeah, that mm-hmm. it was a moment of
talk about that,
the agenda.
No, I mean, really, it's an important argument, and I think you have an argument
I suppose it was a kind in the very recently published book by my Czech colleagues Helena Sadilkova, Dušan Slačka, and Milena Zavodska about the union of Roma people. It was the idea that probably this attempt had so many risks and so many limits that Roma people were unable to cope were unable to accept. Because first of all, the main consequence was the rupture between Roma elites and ordinary Roma. Many of ordinary Roma had totally different issues with their national identity. They struggled for their houses in Slovakia because they were removed to the Czech part of the country and they would like to go back. And it was impossible for them because they lost their right to their houses. And there are a lot of legal cases of Roma people in Slovakia against local authorities. And it was their struggle for their rights and their justice. And it's totally different story than the story presented in the book by Celia Donard. So it was one of the consequences. Yeah. And also it was discussed in the book by Helena Sedilkova and her colleagues. And the second, and for me, it was one of the major consequences of this attempt to be part of this national movement. It was the idea to develop, to build Roma identity aligned with the identity of other nations. So even we have so critical view on nationalism and all these shadows of nationalism, we should think that how destructive this idea could be for the ethnic groups like Roma, so for their collective identity. It's very interesting because it was not kind of struggling for citizenship. It was a kind of struggling for their national identity. And they faced all consequences of this attempt. So I suppose it was.
Yeah. And Vika, could you, really this is a larger question, if you could talk maybe about your dialogue and conversation with colleagues. I think our audience here at New Books Network will be very interested in books or people that you might suggest to read more on this topic. And I know this in sort of coming where I am in San Diego as a U.S. historian, or at least in the U.S., there are some really sort of easy and maybe facile equivalents of placing Black, Romani, and Indigenous together while, of course, reproducing a lot of the stereotypes and a lot of the problems within whiteness studies. So, I mean, you talk in your work about the colorblindness of eliminativism and the sort of epistemic trap of liberal values. So could you suggest maybe some names and people, authors, books that our audience might follow?
Yeah, I would be happy because I'm very optimistic with the new generation, and I address work developed by Vita Zavar, who worked in Ljubljana, and Andrei Bilak, he's a Slovak scholar. And I suppose now he is working on the issue and the consequences of this COVID pandemic for the Roma population in different European countries. And naturally, my colleague in Czech Republic, Jana Abrovska, who develops a lot of research dedicated to a new view on educability of Roma and the role of the new inclusive practices and limits and options of inclusive practices for the Roma. And I would like to stress, and I would like to attract attention to the ERCE grant dedicated to the Roma civic emancipation between the two world wars. And this grant is led by Yelena Marushyakova. And to recent outputs of this project, it's a special issue of social inclusion dedicated to the gypsy policy and Roma activism. Yeah, from the interwar period to contemporary issues. And their book, Roma Voices in History, is a source book with a direct text prepared by Roma in different times in different countries. So I suppose these two outputs of this project are very promising in terms of introducing Roma voices to the historiography of Roma in Central Europe.
Coming out in March, right? I mean, it's coming out with Brill, I think, the source book that you mentioned.
Yeah, exactly. But this book and this special issue are open access. So right now it's possible to read. So it's amazing. Yeah, people who are interested in this problem, they could do it right now. Mm-hmm. And naturally, I suppose one of the very promising directions probably go beyond the boundaries of Central Europe and probably to develop some comparative historiographic researches between Central Europe and Latin America. And for instance, Martin Fortam, who's originally Czech ethnologist, he develops also the Roma issue in Brasilia. So yeah, I like right. reading his text. So yeah.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. So since we're kind of running out of time, I'm going to ask you to speak for Nadia again, if you may, if you can, and talk a little bit for our audience about your current research projects. I know that Nadia had this book that came out with Palgrave, The Courage for Civil Repair, and she's interested in migration. And you have all of your excellent work on disability studies and, you know, critical disability studies in the interwar period. So could you talk a little bit about your current interests, what you're working on with your grants and maybe Nadia's work as well?
Yeah, currently, together with Professor Karl Kasser, we work on the book about health films produced in Central Europe during the interwar period. And I suppose it's very timely book in terms of the contemporary situation, because it would be about propaganda and regimes of authenticity and the role of cultural reflections of building the regimes of authenticity in peripheral parts of Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia mainly. So, yeah, and we're very excited by this project, because it was possible to work during this difficult period. It was possible to collect materials about films, and and that's an interesting point, because naturally in many of the films, Roma were presented as a kind of risks for career and diseases and so on. It would be a little bit different view on objectifying Roma in mass culture. So yeah, it's a very current project. Naturally, I'm not limited by only one project, so it's impossible for us now to focus only one topic or one project. And the second one is race science, and I try to develop some new ideas regarding the new actors who were involved in the debates regarding race science, racism, and probably to extend the issue of resistance to racialized view and dissemination of racialized view. Because, I suppose right now we need to focus on the positive historical experience too.
Yeah, so. I'd like to ask you, if I may, since I do want to talk public policy, do you see your role in either in Czech Republic or Austria or a larger context? I mean, this is a hard question because, you know, in talking about the cases, as you mentioned, juridical rights is a huge issue, or educational rights for Roma, migrancy versus sedentarization. What would be your role, let's say, as a public policy person and as an advocate in many ways, as an ally for Roma issues in the future?
Probably you know that the main strategy of working in favor of Roma rights is strategic litigation. So many of the cases are presented by the strategy regarding housing, education, or for sterilization. And very recent attempt to advance a new law aimed at rebuilding Roma women who were sterilized during the socialist period and first years after 1989. So, but I'm not comfortable with the priority of this strategy, because I suppose if we watch, if we observe the situation in Canada or Australia, which have very compatible practices regarding indigenous population, we could recognize that strategic litigation is not enough. Yeah, it's very important. It's an indispensable part of reconciliation. But for reconciliation, it's not enough to provide the legal grounds. And probably we need to revise education and introduce more historical information for social workers, for educators, in order to support their critical reflection. Why? For instance, education was not so perfect in terms of advancing Roma population. Why the methods and strategies targeted to these Roma families should be transformed in favor of more nuanced, sensitive approach to different dilemmas, such child being or child becoming, or yeah, what is more important for parents, to love their child or to be able to control yeah. their child himself. How to find this balance. And I suppose historically informed argument for helping professionals should be a part of this reconciliation. So it's very important.
Yeah. I want to thank you again, you and Nadia, for writing this book and broadening the discussion, you know, beyond these, issues of just inclusion and exclusion. It is a question of identity, and these larger questions that you bring to the fore, I think, are so important. And I hope our readers will follow this and pick up your book. We here at New Books Network and New Books in Eastern European Studies have been speaking with Victoria Schmidt, together with Nadia Jaworski. They are the authors of Historicizing Roma in Central Europe, Between Critical Whiteness and Epistemic Injustice, a book published by Routledge 2021. Vika, I want to congratulate you on the publication of this book and bringing more discussions and hopefully more curiosity to all of us listening here. Thank you so much.
And thank you for this opportunity. It was great talk for me. Thank you.
And I'm your host here at New Books Network, Stephen Siegel. Until next time.